This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This is the BBC.
Thanks for downloading this episode of In Our Time. There's a reading list to go with it on our website, and you can get news about our programmes if you follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoy the programmes. Hello, Mary Queen of Scots had potential to be one of the most powerful rulers in Europe, yet she was also one of the most vulnerable. In France, when she was a teenage bride to their future king, she was seen as rightful heir to the thrones of England and Ireland, as well as Queen of Scotland and one day of France, which would have been an extraordinary union. She was widowed a year after the marriage, though, and as a devout Catholic returning to an abrasively Protestant Scotland, she struggled to overcome rivalries in her own country. Eventually, after various battles, she fled to Protestant England, where she was implicated in plots to overthrow Elizabeth, and it was Elizabeth herself who signed Mary's death warrant. With me to discuss the life and times of Mary, Queen of Scots, are David Forsyth, Principal Curator in the Scottish History and Archaeology Department at National Museums of Scotland, Anna Groundwater, Teaching Fellow in History at the University of Edinburgh, and John Guy, Fellow of Clare College, University of Cambridge. John Guy, Mary was born in 1542. Who were the most important people in her immediate family at that time?
Her father, James V of Scotland, died 6 days after her birth. So she was brought up in Scotland for the first 5 years by her mother, Mary of Guise, or Marie de Guise, James's second wife, who, of course, had been French princess. Those were very dangerous times because Henry VIII was seizing his opportunity to attempt to unite the crowns of England and Scotland by marrying off his son, Prince Edward, to Mary, even though she was a baby. When Mary was five, she was shipped over to the safety of France. And there, at the court of the French king, Henry II, the most important family members around her and the most important influences on her life and the key players in Henry's court were Francis, Duke of Guise, and Charles, Cardinal of Lorraine, her uncles.
How far did Henry VIII get in this rough wooing attempt to marry off his son to Mary?
Well, in effect, he sparked not quite a civil war in Scotland, but there was a pro-English party and there was a pro-French party. In the end, the pro-French party was in the ascendant, but that took years to play out. Henry tried to impose a treaty on the Scots, which eventually the Scottish Parliament rejected. This was not just diplomacy. I mean, it was effectively war. There were invasions and devastations of the lowland area of Scotland and of Edinburgh.
So she went to France, not surprisingly. Her mother was French, from a grand French family. And what happened then?
Well, she's brought up in the relative luxury and comfort of France. She is still speaking Scottish regularly because four of her immediate attendants are in fact Scottish. So she's fluent in French, but she's also keeping her fluency in Scottish. But the point about this is that certainly by 1550, her uncles, the Francis Duke of Guise, I mean, one of the key war leaders in France, and her uncle, one of the cleverest but also the slipperiest diplomats in France, he's also Archbishop of Rheims, they have a grand plan, a sort of master plan, in which through Mary and by the idea, which of course was there from the moment Mary went to France, that one day she might marry the Dauphin of France, young Francis, the crowns of Scotland and France could be united, but also with the crown of England. There would be a triple monarchy because, of course, looking to the future, Henry's son, Edward, who became the Boy King Edward VI, was a Protestant, and, of course, the Catholics didn't recognise Protestants. And then in the future, of course, down the line, was Elizabeth Tudor, who was not only becoming a Protestant, but, of course, it was Anne Boleyn's daughter, and therefore the Catholics considered her to be illegitimate.
Is it this time she's getting a very good education, Mary, an unusually good education?
She's getting pretty much the same education as Elizabeth got in England. The difference is that whereas Elizabeth is actually rather bookish, Mary is clever. This idea that came from the 19th century that she was somehow a sort of dopey femme fatale, I mean, is just not supported by the evidence. She is almost as able intellectually as Elizabeth, but she has different characteristics. She can reach out to people. She is much more generous than Elizabeth. The thing about Mary is that when she's talking to you, she persuades you that you're the only person in the whole world that really matters.
And her physical appearance is very impressive.
She says she's tall, as so is her mother, Mary of Guise. All the Guises are tall. Elizabeth, of course, is relatively short, only 5'4". I mean, that was actually something later between them. There was always this issue of, who was the better looking and who was the taller and who could play the virginals better, who could speak languages better. But Mary has a very, very good education, but also Mary has a sense of fun. She likes to dress up. One of her favourite things is sort of going into the kitchen and making quince marmalade, coating, that sort of thing. She likes riding. She's a cultured woman. But the key thing about the time in France is this Franco-British policy, because when we move on and Elizabeth becomes queen in 1558, the uncles do something that determines what is going to happen in terms of Anglo-Marian relations, really, for the rest of the story, which is they quarter the arms of England, France and Scotland on the, essentially the, Mary and Francis's crockery. And they invite the English ambassador, Nicholas Throckmorton, to dinner and serve him his dinner on a silver plate, embossed with the arms of England. When Mary goes to chapel, the ushers cry, "Make way for the Queen of England." This is deliberately provocative to establish Mary's claim as the great granddaughter of Henry VII, of course, to the throne. Exactly.
Anna Groundwater, she returned to Scotland after her French husband died. There was a year between them. He was a young lad, and it was only a year of marriage. Did she have any other options?
I think by that point, no, she didn't.
How old is she now? About
16. She returns to Scotland when she's 18. Mm. She could have tried to hang on at the court in France, but her mother-in-law, Catherine de Medici, seriously didn't want her around. They didn't have a good relationship. Sorry.
Why is that?
Well, I think what Catherine de Medici didn't like was the de Guise power and influence that came when they had Mary there, as John says, as part of this sort of master plan. Whilst Mary was Dauphin and then Queen, of course, it gave the de Guises a lot of influence, a lot of power. But as soon as she lost that position, the de Guises were eclipsed, really effectively, because then the new king was Catherine de Medici's son, Charles IX, over whom she was able to exert quite a bit of power, certainly to begin with.
So the only option was to get out, as you're saying?
Yeah, she had to get married. Otherwise, she could have, I suppose, gone somewhere else in Europe. But I think really what's probably more important here is that she had a kingdom to run. I suppose one of the questions is why wouldn't she have gone back to Scotland? She was Queen of Scotland. Scotland wasn't a bad country. It wasn't a bad place to be. Maybe it wasn't as glittering a court as France, but she had been Queen of Scotland since virtually from birth.
While she'd been in France, what connections had she kept with Scotland? We've been told she spoke the language every day, but what other connections did she have?
Well, there's a frequent correspondence between her and her mother. But there are also...
Who's living in Edinburgh?
Who's living in Edinburgh, yeah. And around. Yeah. And her mother, in fact, came out to see her in France in 1551, and bringing actually, I think, two of her half-brothers, her illegitimate half-brothers, also came out to the court. There was also a determined attempt to keep her informed of what was going on in Scotland so that she was aware of the situation in Scotland. And I think because of that, she was very aware that there was a Protestant revolution going on in Scotland at the time.
So she came back as a Catholic who hadn't been to the country for a very long time. She probably scarcely remember it, really, into an abrasively Protestant, which is what it was before, but it is fair enough, an abrasively Protestant country, very demanding of its Protestantism, and she was a devout Roman Catholic. How did she manage to exercise any control at all?
Well, I think key here is that she did come back as the absolute acknowledged monarch. There hadn't been any attempt to challenge her right to rule, her legitimacy, and in fact, her illegitimate half-brother, James Stuart, who becomes the Earl of Murray, who's a committed Protestant, he comes out to ask her to come back. So, you know, she's being asked to come back. She's declared an interest in coming back. And this is a place where she can exert power. I think there's one other point here is, yes, there's been a Protestant revolution. The monarchy has been challenged successfully on the religion of the country. But that's not to say that Scotland didn't overnight become Protestant. There were seriously Protestant figures around, powerful Protestant figures around, but not everyone. You know, you don't change your faith overnight.
David Forsyth, so she's back there. She's a Catholic, though. The Mass is allowed to be said only in the chapel. Only in the Royal Chapel. How did she adapt? Did she adapt? She's got Protestant Scotland in front of her. She walks out of the chapel at Holyrood. What does she do then?
Well, she can hear the Edinburgh mob baying. The first day that Mass is said at Holyrood House, the Protestant mob are baying at the door, and the half-brother, illegitimate half-brother James, has to help to ensure that the Mass goes ahead. She's very, I think, diplomatic. She shows great realpolitik in realising that this is a reformed country. But let's not forget, it's still the Protestant Reformation is still at a very early stage. There are great pockets of Roman Catholicism. But Mary takes a practical approach. She proclaims that there'll be no change to the religion. She's been made quite clear to her from the half-brother that the Mass is only to be said within the confines of Holyrood House in Edinburgh. When she tries to say it, have it said in Stirling, there's trouble there. So she respects, if you like, the faith of her subjects. She even starts to accommodate in a way that she'll attend Protestant baptisms. She'll listen to some Protestant preachers that she finds acceptable. So I think she treads a very careful, determined, realpolitik, practical line. She knows that, because for Mary, the important thing is that she is the anointed Queen of Scots. She has that authority.
She goes so far as to put down a Catholic rebellion, doesn't she?
She does indeed. So she puts down the rebellion in the north by the great Gordon in the northeast, the great Gordon family interest, one of the leading Scottish noble families. So she's showing great even handedness in terms of her dealing with religion.
But you're talking about it being embryonic, as it were, the Protestant thing. You're still quite violent. You have this man, John Knox, writing against the monstrous regiment of women. He sees her four or five times. The latest scholarship says the first two or three times were reasonably amicable. And the fourth time he told her who she should marry. And when she went out, we are told, she burst into tears, which is rather unusual for her.
That's correct. I mean, the conversations, for want of a better word, with Knox become more and more strident. The first one is about the monstrous regiment of women. It's about the political position of...
Meaning women in power.
Meaning women in power, yes. Well, so Mary de Guise, Mary Tudor, Elizabeth, who obviously was on her side, on Knox's side, and Mary herself. But they become more about religion. Knox trying to, you know, persuade her that she's not really a legitimate monarch through her religion. I think the thing about Mary is that she's been born, she's been schooled in queenship. She holds the line. These floods of tears tend to come after Knox, Master Knox, has left the room. But in terms of the leadership, the political leaders are her half brother James Stuart. I mean, Knox is not the Scottish Protestant Reformation is a political movement.
Two things here, picking up from what you said. First is she's very straightforward about her being Queen of Scots. When challenged by the great Catherine de Medici, when she came to the nursery saying, "Why do you not bow to the Queen of France?" And this girl immediately replied, "Why do you not bow to the Queen of Scots?"
So Mary has confidence, yes.
From the beginning. Secondly, about people who advised her, and we're going to come to the English advisers in a minute, Liz, who are let's say they were very impressive. Yes. They were devious, they were deceitful, they were all sorts, but they were very impressive. Did she have a like group of people advising her?
But what I would say, that I think one thing that Mary felt, if she had people like Walsingham and Cecil around her in her immediate circle, she may have been more successful. There was the Scottish court politics fell into various cabals. There were people like Maitland of Leffington, known as the Machiavelli of Scotland, Michael Mack. I think Mary felt that because of these great regional interests in Scotland, the Lennoxes, the Gordons, the people around the court, the half-brother, that she really was not best served by some of these so-called advisers.
And they had their own rivalries as well.
And they had their own, the disputatious nature of early modern Scottish politics.
So she's there, this young girl still. Her husband has died, her mother has died, her favourite uncle who really looked after her has died.
And the father
That's right, and her father. And she's back in this sort of foreign country, which is her own. Mm-hmm. John Galley, did she have really dangerous enemies, and who were they?
Well, it isn't Elizabeth. I mean, this is the common...
Not at this stage.
This is a common assumption.
15, 16,
this is a common assumption that it is. But, of course, at this early stage, both Elizabeth and Mary, as it might whimsically be said, are fully paid-up members of the Women Monarchs Trade Union.
More importantly than that, I mean, not more importantly, you know what you're talking about, but they were both... Elizabeth, both of them, were very well aware at the time that they had been anointed, divinely anointed, to be in the position they were. And this mattered to them more than anything else. And that is the bond, serious bond. And it played a part right the way through.
Well, this is exactly right, because then divine right kingship, you know, meant exactly what it said. But, of course, this was not so for... William Cecil, Elizabeth's chief minister, and the most important single fact to know about the early Elizabethan regime is that for Cecil, Elizabeth was Protestant but not Protestant enough. And the difference in their, if you like, their intellectual DNA is that both Mary and Elizabeth believe that the first thing that matters when you're talking about, say, the succession to the throne is dynastic right, is heredity and not religion, whereas Cecil believes that there should be some sort of religious test to make sure... I mean, Cecil and Knox are on the same wavelength here. They believe that an idolatrous ruler, which effectively means a Catholic ruler, and in particular a Catholic idolatress, should never be the queen. And what Cecil wants to do from the beginning is to exclude Mary from the succession using Parliament, which, of course, Elizabeth, you know, finds absolutely repulsive.
So her greatest enemies outside Scotland is Cecil Lord Burghley, Queen Elizabeth's advisor over many, many years, who runs things. Sometimes she's very angry that he does things without her authority, but he's there all the time. He is against her from the start. He plots against her from the start. He undermines her. He sets up traps and schemes and so on. So he's out there after her. Who was on her side on a grand order? She married Darnley. Why did she marry him?
I think Darnley was... probably...
Who was he to start with?
Okay, so Henry Darnley, was a grandson of Margaret Tudor, who had married James IV of Scotland, and thus he was the same degree of relation to Mary Tudor as Mary was herself. So they were both grandchildren of Margaret Tudor, both grandchildren, great-grandchildren of Henry VII. So... he had, in his own right, a claim to the English throne as well. And he was also relatively ambivalent around his religion, so he could be quite Catholic. He could also be Protestant when he needed to be.
How and why did she pick him out? Was he picked out for her, or did she see him, or did he come and woo her? What happened?
Yeah, so... it wasn't, yes. To start with, a whole load of other people were offered or suggested, none of whom really were very suitable. So there was the Don Carlos of Spain, Philip II's son, who became mad, and then also the Earl of Arran in Scotland, who also became mad.
So not a great choice, really.
There really wasn't a great choice out there. And the other problem is that you marry a foreigner, you get into that situation that Mary Tudor had with Philip II of Spain, that you've got a foreigner who could potentially make a claim to that throne.
So how did she get Darnley?
So Darnley,
or vice versa.
I don't know. What do you think? Elizabeth slipped up there a bit and let him go.
I've got two hands going up.
Yeah, sorry.
David, you come in.
Elizabeth lets Darnley travel to Scotland and then realises a mistake. Darnley, of course, is a born Englishman, so this also adds to the genealogical claim to the throne.
It's also partly on the rebound, because one of the silliest things, one of the very few silly things Elizabeth ever did, was to try to foist Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, her own favourite. And, you know,
while we think we're sort of almost proved lover.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Elizabeth's idea was that they would all live together in a ménage à trois in the south of England. I mean, this was, you know, and I mean, to Mary, that was, you know, a red rag to a bull. But Darnley...
So actually, let's get this straight, because I think listeners are going to be rather surprised. Elizabeth proposed to her cousin that they live together in the south of England with Elizabeth's lover, whom she made an earl, so he could be earl enough to marry her cousin.
Absolutely.
What a wheeze.
Absolutely. but the thing about Darnley was that he was one of these very, very smooth young men who knew how to behave until the ring was on the finger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The trouble starts once the ring's on the finger.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And also Darnley is one of the few men that can look Mary in the eye, because he's long of leg, as Mary describes him.
She's five foot eleven.
He's a tall man, and he was certainly fanciful.
We are told he arrives there with syphilis, which opens up questions for the future James. We've got to leave that alone, unfortunately. Anyway, they get married, and he drinks a lot, and he's soon a drunken sot.
Womanizes.
And why was he murdered? And who did it? That's up to you, David.
that's a $6 million question. Well, he's Catholic, normally. He is... The Scottish advisors around Mary do not like Darnley. He's inveigled into the whole Rizzio.
Who's Rizzio?
Well, this was the
Peter... Well, you tell us who Rizzio is.
Rizzio was a fine bass singer. He was from the Savoy Court, the ambassador.
That's a funny way to introduce
it. He was our French secretary and became very close to Mary. Mary spent a lot of time with him. And, of course, the so-called advisors or plotters around Mary used Rizzio to really fire up Darnley and whisper all sorts of, you know, crude innuendo about what the relationship between Mary and Rizzio might be.
And Rizzio was murdered, and one of the murders was Darnley.
Darnley's implicated in the plot.
And the root of the problem is that once Darnley and Mary are married, Darnley wants to be King of Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about the 16th century is that rank does not trump gender. Even the person who was attempting to write a book defending Elizabeth as Queen of England said that a woman may rule as a magistrate but must obey as a wife. And Mary, one of Mary's mistakes is that before the wedding she tells Darnley she will make him King of Scotland, but after the wedding she realises what he's really like and refuses. And after that he plots against her to attempt to get the crown matrimonial, and this leads to
crown matrimonial is that he gets to be king.
And I mean to cut to the quick, this leads to great turbulence in Scotland. In the process of that turbulence, Mary's secretary Rizzio gets murdered. The people who've done that are expelled from the country, and of course in London, William Cecil wants to get those people back, because those people are his Scottish allies. They're all Protestant. He wants to work with them. A situation is reached in which Darnley begins to plot against Mary in a way that looks like he will actually even attempt to depose her.
Hold on, it's getting very overpopulated. Just a second. Anna here. So, Darnley, let's keep it clear. She's married Darnley. They've had this child, James, who becomes later James.
Mm-hmm.
Crucially, right. Can you tell, did that change the balance of power in Mary's favour? Crucially, what effect did that have?
Well, it immediately gave her that heir that's your primary duty as queen to provide. And it certainly was probably one of the highest points of her life, was having had this son, the long-for son and heir. She has a baptism ceremony at Stirling Castle, which was a splendiferous affair. And it really showed Mary at her best, the sort of the majesty of monarchy, the splendour of the court. It was very impressive. People heard about it abroad. And that really was her high point. And it, but at that point, crucially, Darnley goes, oh, I'm not going to bother. I'm not coming to the baptism. So this was very problematic, because that's the sort of thing you'd do if you were saying, this child isn't mine. So it was potentially very, very harmful, extremely disloyal. And also he was writing letters out of the country at this point to get support from the Pope or whoever against Mary.
She had the child soon after she met him. Was the child his, David?
Oh, it was certainly Mary's.
We know that really, honestly, that it wasn't the question I asked. Come on, but face up to it. Was it his? I just occurred to me then. Anna's saying it might not have been his child. What's the odds there?
Oh, I think it was Stanley's child. This is James. He's a real Stuart.
Okay, so let's go for the murder of Darnley. He is murdered, and then what? Would you like to take that up?
Well, I think the thing about the murder is the whole Kirkfield explosion. Mm-hmm. The body
what's
is
the
found.
But
so Darnley is enticed back to Edinburgh. Comes back with is enticed back to Edinburgh with Mary. He's staying in lodgings in an area of the sort of upscale area of the city called Kirkfield, near where the National Museum is now. And he there's a huge explosion.
The
gunpowder plot, if you like, a Scottish gunpowder plot, that the lodgings that he's in are completely destroyed, but the body of Darnley and the night servant are found in the orchard, unharmed. Not unharmed, he's dead, obviously, but unsinged from any explosion. There are no marks on his body. So it's the whole nature of that event.
I mean, the event is triggered because at the baptism, the English ambassador, who's been put there by Cecil, who's one of his closest allies.
Cecil's around everywhere.
Yeah, he's everywhere.
He's partly
controlling these events. The Earl of Bedford, who's the ambassador put there by Cecil, gets Mary, who is too generous on this occasion, to pardon the people who'd murdered Darnley and let them back into England. And the key player here is the Earl of Morton, who comes back in determined to murder Darnley for betraying their bonds, their agreement.
They're going to murder Richard.
Exactly. So this is a revenge killing. But of course, the question is, my view of this, and you know, after
the
studying
question
this
is,
for many
was she
years,
part of it?
Yeah. This is
what's
the key
your
question.
Answer to that?
And my answer to that is that she was not part of it. But this doesn't mean that she was a wimp. Darnley had by this time become totally unmanageable, uncontrollable, and my belief
in what way the drink
because most seriously he was threatening to depose Mary and rule in the name of Prince James, and to support this, you know, by if necessarily by funding and if necessary military support from the European Catholic powers. So everyone agreed, all the people around Mary agreed that something had to be done about this. In order to cope with this, my reading of the sources is that Mary had a plan, and it was to go and... Darnley, had, after he'd finished sulking after the baptism, because he's now got more advanced syphilis, has gone off to his sort of, if you like, ancestral estates near Glasgow. She goes to fetch him back. My belief is that she was going to bring him to Craigmillar Castle, just outside Edinburgh, 3 miles outside Edinburgh, and keep him locked up there, if necessary, for the rest of his life. However, the people around her, who she's got enemies inside Scotland, believe that they not only want to kill Darnley, they want to destabilise Mary. And I mean, if you're going to kill Darnley and you want it to go unobserved, you don't do it in a gunpowder plot in the middle of Edinburgh.
Anna, can you take us on from that? So Darnley is murdered. Mm-hmm. How does that affect Mary? Let's focus again on Mary, mm-hmm. because there's lots mm-hmm. of Cecil and all sorts of people turning up, which is right and proper. But so how does that affect her? He's been murdered. Do a lot of people think she's implicated? Do people think it's a good thing, a bad thing, or what thing? What's going on?
OK, so in Edinburgh, very quickly after Darnley's murder, placards appear which show pictures of Mary as...
What would appear, sorry?
Placards, posters
yeah.
of Mary as a mermaid, which was a person of ill repute.
A prostitute.
Yeah.
Right.
And then underneath a picture of the hare, which was the crest of the Earl of Bothwell, who was also accused of being, who was certainly part of the murder of
Bothwell
Darnley.
Just come on the scene. Can you give us two or three sentences about Bothwell?
Is a Protestant. He's a hard man from the borders. He's got quite a sizable armed following, like a lot of these other earls do. And he is the one person that has come back in support of Mary And also, indeed, in support of her mother at one point. So he's someone with a lot of military power, someone that she trusts.
He's independently rich. All those are Protestant. Yeah. He supports her, and he supports France as well. So he's an unusual character.
He's not keen on the English. And in a way, you know, to be a Protestant and not to be keen on the English is almost, unusual. You know, the opposite to the normal way of doing things.
Do you want to come in, David?
Yeah, that's good. He's a strange amalgam. Yeah. I mean, he is a bit of a border's hard man. Mm-hmm. But he's been at the court in France. Mm-hmm. He's cultured. Mm-hmm. If you look at the beautiful little miniature Noel that the Scottish National Portrait Gallery has, you know, he looks very much regal or part of the courtly, you know, courtly world. But I think he's got an armband. He's a regional magnate.
And what happens that she marries him? Sorry, John, you want to come in.
He's been in alliance with this Morton character, but after the murder, of course, there's a falling out, if you like, among the thieves. Mm. And the Earl of Bothwell, you know, who sees an opportunity here, thinks that now that Mary is in this terrible crisis, I mean, after all, her husband has been murdered in a gunpowder plot, the reverberations of this are all over Europe, you know, where, of course, in Catholic Europe, this is seen as a regicide. Even Elizabeth thinks that it's a regicide, because, after all, Darnley is her cousin too. So Bothwell steps, you know, onto the stage and says to Mary, I can be your protector. And in this position of, you know, emotional crisis and political crisis for her, she accepts, and then Bothwell does in a way what all the men do at this time. He demands marriage as the price of protection. Mm-hmm. And then it all goes wrong. Then it all happens again.
Mm-hmm. How does it all go wrong, Anna?
Well, she marries him. Absolute disaster. Because in doing so, she's threatening the power of all those other powerful Scottish nobles, because he's there right by her side and has got that claim then to the throne, to power. And he thus, as John's saying, manages to alienate all these people that he has actually been in a bond with up until then.
Can I ask an obvious, very obvious question here? Was being a woman particularly difficult? Her advisers weren't as good as Elizabeth's advisers by a long chalk, nor as consistent, and nobody in the world was as implacable as Cecil. But putting that to aside, was just being a woman, is it a soft question, or what do you say?
Well, I certainly think that we should look at Mary's rule as Mary as a ruler rather than a female ruler to start with. You know, was she an effective ruler? And my answer to that would be, she was variable because she was human. Sometimes she got it right, sometimes she got it disastrously wrong. But being a female ruler definitely did come with a few problems, particularly because you've got to get married. And as John was saying, you know, you're meant to obey your husband in this time. And that left her vulnerable. Either she marries someone in Scotland, she gets a whole load of jealous Scottish nobles, she marries a foreigner, she gets people worried about that. So the whole question of her marriage leaves her vulnerable and leaves her open to these things where you get someone like Darnley, someone like Bothwell, who want more than just marriage. They want power.
Before we take her, before she goes to England, David, there's a phase in her life where she gets on a horse and goes into battle and wins things, doesn't she?
She is,
until finally she doesn't. But let's talk about winning first.
Well, she does. She's quite. This is one of the dynamic natures of Mary. She does lead troops into battle. I don't think, John, there are many other Renaissance queens that do that. She's very visible. After her various interventions when she's been in imprisonment and captivity, it is surprising just again how many men she can put in the field. So despite this religious disparity, she maintains, you know, elements of support and popularity.
And she wins early on with her battle, doesn't she?
She does, yeah. She's quite effective. She's got good military men with her, but she does win have military success.
And of course, Bothwell had supported her at that time. He'd come back to support her at that moment. I mean, she can be incredibly decisive. And the other thing about Mary is that she is a bit of a risk taker. Unlike Elizabeth, of course, who always plays for time. I mean, in a crisis, Mary will say, "I've got to do something." Elizabeth will say, "I've got to do absolutely nothing." So yes, she gets on a horse with a steel cap and a gun in her holster. And she rides and she throws these people out of Scotland. But look, Rizzio's been murdered, Darnley's been murdered. You know, that's too much for one woman in this world in which you are in a vice. Because if you marry, you're in peril from your an ambitious husband. And if you don't marry, you're in a dynastic cul-de-sac because you can't have an heir.
And then she lost one big battle. Was it Pinkie? Where she lost the battle, David? And then she fled. She made what all of you call a major miscalculation by fleeing to Carlisle. Carlisle Castle, across the border, across the Solway into England.
Well, I think that Anna mentioned it earlier in the programme about the co-sanguinity between Mary and Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. She throws herself on her cousin, her sister, the Queen, because of that belief that they're both anointed mm-hmm. queens. Elizabeth is not going to harm her.
How old is she at this stage? Sorry, Mary.
She's in her 20s for this time, because this is the end of the
25?
25, yeah. So this is the end of the personal reign.
So she loses that battle. Why did she decide that was the only option?
That was a mistake.
It was a mistake, yes. I think this is the biggest mistake.
If she told up in Scotland...
But who'd advise her? So she's got these options. She's gone back, she's toughed it out, here, there, she's faced John Knox, she's faced all the others. Then she decides to go across the Solway to Carlisle. Who advised her? Why did she decide to do it? John, you're waving your hand.
Well, she loses the battle and then she's imprisoned in Lochleven for a year. And she escapes from Lochleven and then she raises her supporters, because by this time her enemies have become so unpopular in Scotland she can actually raise a party. But she actually loses the battle and then she flees. No one is advising her. She decides to do that exactly off her own bat because she believes that this relationship, woman to woman, with Elizabeth is such that if she can only meet Elizabeth and talk to her sister queen, as she calls her, this will go away.
Can you briskly tell us the part the casket letters played? I want to get it in, but let's be short.
Of course. Once Mary is in England, the thing that the Earl of Murray, who of course by now is the regent, and of course Cecil wants, is that Elizabeth will recognise Murray as the regent in Scotland, ruling in the name of Prince James. And to try and achieve that, the claim is made that 8 letters, allegedly from Mary to Bothwell, were found in a silver box at Holyrood after she was taken to Lochleven. And those letters supposedly prove that, first of all, Mary was complicit in Darnley's murder, and secondly, that she was in an adulterous relationship with Bothwell before Darnley was dead. Now, there are these 8 letters. I examined them at huge length in 2004. 3 are manifestly letters to Darnley while their relationship was breaking up. 3 are of different versions of one letter to Bothwell that had been antedated by several weeks to make it look incriminating. There's a letter that Mary did write, but not at the date or the time that it's said to be. And there's a long letter called the Long Glasgow Letter, on which the jury is still out. But in my opinion, 1500 to 1800 words are genuine, but 1000 to 1200 words are forgeries.
So it was basically, she was set up again, wasn't she? Right. There was other things going on in Europe that made her position. Can you skim through those and then we can get back to her in Carlisle Castle?
Yeah. The problem that Mary faced is that on the continent you have the beginning of the Counter-Reformation happening. Catholics hitting back at all these Protestant reformations going on. In France, you've got it descending into the French wars of religion. So where she might have perhaps hoped for some support from the De Guises, they're suddenly embroiled in effectively a religious civil war. In the Netherlands, the Dutch are revolting, and Philip II is sending in his forces to try and put down that what was effectively to become a Protestant rebellion there. It didn't quite start like that. And then you've got Philip II obviously wanting to control his land. Sorry, I should make that clear. He owns effectively the Netherlands, the Low Countries at this point. So they're rebelling against his rule. He's a committed Catholic.
So the Catholics are on the rampage.
The Catholics are
on
the rampage.
And the Protestants are worried because it's a big rampage and Spain is very powerful and got lots of fleets, lots of soldiers, lots of money.
And also Elizabeth doesn't want to annoy Philip II at that point either.
No. Is there any way, Dave Forsyth, in which her having the son... She's got the son.
The insurance policy.
She's in Carlisle. I keep mentioning Carlisle Castle.
I can't see that. I wonder why.
Well, no, not really. It's just because she's there. And I want to talk a bit more about it, if you don't mind.
No.
But is anywhere persons around her son or son said, look, this is the mother of our future king. She can't be over there. We want her back here. Did that go on at all?
Well, I mean, the main man round the son, of course, is Buchanan, formerly Mary's one of Mary's advisors, the man who wrote
a brutal teacher, a brutal little boy.
Whether he deserved it or not, he got a sound beating. And of course, James is brought up or schooled by this man who tells him that his mother is a murderess and an adulteress. And this is really why James has a very difficult relationship with his mother.
Yeah, but
and
that isn't memory. The question I'm asking. Weren't there people there when she left saying, hold on, she's the mother of a future king, she is still Queen of Scots, let's bring her back across the Solway and try to make do with it, make it work, Anna?
There's a civil war going on in Scotland. It's not a severe civil war, but there is civil war. It's called the Marian Wars. There was a significant number of people who did still support Mary, the Queen's man. Yeah. But the problem was they didn't own the body of the prince, the king himself.
I've just seen our little time we've got left. I'm in a shock. You're going to have to be very fast, John. She's in England for 19 years, imprisoned, trying to make deals with Elizabeth, almost again and again, making Elizabeth willing, she's willing, again and again, Cecil undermines it. Can you give me a rather extended view of that summary?
Yeah, I mean, that's the basic outline. And at first, Mary is, it's almost like a sort of court in exile. She's a cuckoo in Elizabeth's nest. But of course, there's a big rebellion in England in 1569 in the north, the Northern Rising. You know, 6,000 rebels. It's not just the rebellion that's put down. It's put down extraordinarily brutally. But 60 of those rebels escape to the continent and become, if you like, Mary's supporters on the continent. One of the aims of the rebels was to restore the mass, restore Catholicism, and put Mary on the throne. But I personally do not believe that Mary was a great threat to Elizabeth herself until the 1580s, at which point the international situation, which Anna's been describing, has reached boiling point. And at that point, of course, it isn't just that Catholics want her on the throne, it's that she is rejected by her own son. In 1581, Mary puts forward a proposal that she should rule on a co-ruler basis with James. James rats on her and allies with Elizabeth.
Very briefly, we've got to get let's forget the Ridolfi papers. The Babington plot, Babington wrote her a letter saying, will you join a conspiracy? She answered the letter. Walsingham then falsified the letter by adding other names, and he, like Cecil, set her up, and that with the Babington plot could not, it at the time said, be denied, and Elizabeth, I'm told, you know, had no alternative but to pronounce her guilty, and she was executed.
And I mean, that was the intention of Walsingham and Cecil in setting her up, was that it would force Elizabeth's hand finally to sign that death warrant. But I think James helped to sign that death warrant too by signing an Anglo-Scottish alliance in 1586, her son, which made no reference to Mary at all.
So she was left friendless, but also, well, not all that old. She's still very attractive.
He designed the throne of England.
And Elizabeth wrung her hands.
And then it's all a bit of sleight of hand, isn't it? They're all signing that letter.
Put the letter in the bin.
Yeah. To stop. It's awful. We've got to stop. There we are. Thanks, Anna Groundwater. John,
got it right. Stuart.
John, we've got to stop. Anna Groundwater, John Guy, David Forsyth. Thank you very much. Next week, we'll be talking about parasitism. Thanks for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
This is the extra, really, which the podcast persons get. Hello, podcast persons. And I usually say, what do we miss out? And then I sit back. So it's up to you.
Lots. So much.
What did I miss out? Did we miss out that was... Did we miss anything out that was critical?
I'd like to say one particular thing, which is about the nature of Scottish government. And I think there are two sort of slightly opposing views here of it. So when she came back, was she faced with, I think you've called it tribal politics, or which she really was not going to ever be able to come? Or was it that she came back to a situation which, if she had asserted her authority consistently, that she would have been able to take much more control than she did? And I think one of the things that she didn't do was to pack the Privy Council with her supporters. If she had done that...
Why didn't she do that?
To me, this is extraordinary, and I don't understand why she didn't pack the Privy Council in Scotland with her supporters. And if she had, I think it might have been a different
religion
story.
Religion aside, it may have been a different story.
Because I think with the religious thing, she was happy to tread that line.
She was. And even taking criticism from Catholic monarchs and from the papacy, that you're not doing much to sort out these heretics in your kingdom. So that, I think, again, shows this realpolitik. So I suppose in the way, if she's...
Is that her again? I'm just a bit obsessed with the advisors.
The advisors.
It's difficult to do. I mean, when she comes back... Essentially, these advisors, of whom two have been to see her in France to sort of try and make terms beforehand, they expect her, in a sense, to fail and the whole thing to be a catastrophe, which, of course, for James Stuart, Earl of Murray, could be rather a good thing, because as the illegitimate son of James V, he's the Edmund in King Lear. He thinks he really should, be the king. But, of course, when Mary comes back, because of this politique approach that she takes, which David's described, she's doing extremely well, and by the end of the first year, Maitland of Lethington is saying, "Blimey, she's so good. If anything's amiss, the fault lies in ourselves." And I think that she was so successful until she married Darnley. The problem is, the problem is, if you're a woman monarch in the 16th century, you're stuffed, because if you marry, the bloke will try and take over, and if you don't, you're in this dynastic cul-de-sac, and then everybody's wondering about the future and what's going to happen.
Darnley had been a better character, there was a chance there.
Well, I had this debate with Antonia Fraser in Westminster Abbey about if Elizabeth had married, Robert Dudley. And Antonia's view was, that could have worked because, Dudley would have behaved. And I mean, my reaction was, no, the guy was a popinjay, it would have gone exactly the same way. One reason why Elizabeth didn't marry, in my opinion, was because she'd sussed this out as an adolescent, with all the Tom Seymour business, and she'd sussed it out, with the struggle that she got to the throne, and then she saw it again beginning to unfold in her own reign, and particularly with Mary. Why am I going to? I'm not going to go down that road.
But I think if Darnley had been a more reliable character, the system of government was there for her to take the reins of. The structure was there. The relationships were there. She just had to. Jenny Wormwood always says, "Rise above faction and assert her authority," and I'm very much in agreement with that. And that's what she ultimately failed to do.
But a divisionally difficult
she's
mission.
She's in Carlisle Castle, and I didn't manage to get it.
No, I saw him. I would
be surprised to hear that. I was born in Carlisle.
Yeah, I know you are.
She's in Carlisle Castle, there's all sorts of places in Cumberland called Weary Hall and all that, where she's supposed to have stayed. She should have meandered through the north of England.
Continually coming further south to come into the fulcrum of Cecil. I mean, the Carlisle thing is interesting because she's convinced because of this that her cousin, her sisterly anointed queen, that she's a guest. There's a sort of slow realisation that she's not a guest.
But again, this is Cecil, because, I mean, the minute she's at Carlisle, Cecil sends, Francis Knowles up. I mean, essentially the police go up to sort of hem her in, and she's very closely closely guarded.
The fate is sealed, isn't it?
How long is she at the castle in Carlisle? Sorry.
And Elizabeth, at this point, I mean, the paradox of this scenario is that at this moment, Elizabeth, probably was prepared to meet her and talk about it woman to woman, but Cecil blocks it. Just as in 1562, when a meeting actually was arranged and it was all going to happen, Cecil had written the equivalent of the press communique, cancelling the meeting 2 weeks before anything had happened to actually justify the meeting being cancelled.
And then he didn't want them to get together.
I'm being a bob, but how long was she in Carlisle? I'm not being silly about this. Was it?
Three months.
Then she's gradually brought down to Tutbury, and then she's
Shropshire,
then with the Earl of Shrewsbury, because Derbyshire being at the county where you're furthest from the coast at any point. Shrewsbury Castle, actually. Shrewsbury Castle.
But there was the opportunity still, I think, in 69, for her to have negotiated a settlement whereby she could have been restored to the Scottish throne, but Cecil made sure that didn't happen.
And poor he's the nemesis.
And even Elizabeth knew I mean, Elizabeth wouldn't give a decision at the meeting, which, or the commission, as it's called, which examined the casket letters, because she knew they were dodgy, and the thing was just left in abeyance. Yep. You know, yeah. I mean, it wasn't. Some historians say it's like the sort of Scottish verdict of not proven, but actually, it's just shut the whole thing down, and everyone was sworn to secrecy. And then, blow me, you know, after the Ridolfi plot, which we didn't talk about on air, but after the first of these, sort of more specific plots, what does Cecil do? He tries to get Mary executed, and shortly before the summoning of the 1572 Parliament, in which he and his people try to get Mary executed, he publishes the casket letters in phony Scots anonymously.
Yes.
Pretends it was done by the Scots. Even Buchanan. Writes in and says, "Hang on, not me, Gov. This was nothing to do with me." Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy is a skilled political operator. Of the most, where Mary was concerned.
Yeah.
The most sort of messianic.
I didn't realise. I mean, I read that sort of stuff at university and before that at school, but so I thought I knew quite a bit about it. Well, there was recognitions all the way, but that was a while ago. I didn't realise he'd kind of stalked her since the beginning of the
15th. Well, John mentioned the arms.
In 1559, at the height of the revolt of the Protestant lords in Scotland, he wrote a sort of master plan saying that if Mary, as an absentee ruler at that point, doesn't get rid of idolatry in Scotland, doesn't get rid of French influence, then it pleases Almighty God to depose her.
He could read the mind,
absolutely extraordinary. And at the moment when she is forced to abdicate at Lochleven, Elizabeth is absolutely horrified because she thinks that the abdication of a divine right monarch is worse than whoever killed Lord Darnley.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She gives Nicholas Throckmorton, who's the ambassador she sends up, the sort of Henry Kissinger type envoy she sends up to try and sort of get this sorted, get her out of jail, get her restored of Queen of Scotland, get her money back. Cecil gives Throckmorton contrary instructions, keep her in, don't let her out. If she does get out, she's to absolutely have no money and Scotland's got to be ruled by a council of 24 nobles led by Murray. It destroys Throckmorton's career. But at the end of his instructions, as a private sort of doodle at the end, and in the draft of them, this is my eureka moment in the National Archives, Cecil writes, a failure inter emptor per Joash Regem. Athalia was assassinated so that Joash could be king. And this is pure Knox out of the first blast of the trumpet. Athalia, like Jezebel, the idolatrous rulers of Israel who were deposed in favour of a regency of a young boy with a council of nobles. Bingo.
Why did finish his career? Because he obeyed the wrong person.
Because you couldn't cope with this. You couldn't satisfy them both.
He couldn't serve two masters or one master, one mistress.
John, how much do you think that Cecil had that sort of almost a British, well, certainly an Anglo-Scottish vision,
Protestant Anglo-Scottish.
I mean, he talks about a one monarchy in the 1560s. And the other thing he says is that religion is the biggest band
that's going to be the bond
that will bring us together, and that was Protestant.
Absolutely. He's one of the very first people to use this language in Edward VI's reign, and it's bound by religion. And what I think his master plan was for a Protestant British Isles.
Yes.
But of course the problem for the Scots was it was to be done in Cecil's view on the basis of English superiority.
And the Scots could never accept that.
If it had been done on the basis of equality, this could well have happened.
Work in inverted commas in 1603 because there was
the migration north to south of James.
But there's a 40-year delay because in order for it to work, you have to get rid of Elizabeth because it's the one thing that she
wants.
This is absolutely abhorrent to her.
And you need to get rid of Mary.
I think we've got a producer pawing the ground outside the door to make you an offer you really can't refuse.
Oh dear.
You've got enough now, yeah?
I'd love coffee.
Oh, I'd love a coffee, Simon. Yes, please.
There are many more history and discussion programmes from Radio 4 to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.